Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The 2014 Olympics begin on Friday in Sochi, Russia, amid a handful of concerns, not the least of which is the fact that last June Russia passed a law that bans gay propaganda to minors. The impact of the legislation has been unclear in the months leading up to the Sochi Olympics. Russia has come under harsh scrutiny for human rights abuses of gay protesters by the government and vigilante groups. But Russian President Vladimir Putin says Olympic athletes and spectators need not worry.
We aren't banning anything. We aren't rounding up anyone. We have no criminal punishment for such relations, unlike many other countries. So one can feel relaxed and at ease. But please leave the children in peace.
That's a recent speech by Vladimir Putin translated into English. For more on this, we want to welcome to the show David Herzenhorn. He's New York Times Russia Bureau Chief. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
So Russian President Vladimir Putin, we see him hang gliding, hunting, and suiting up with the Russian national hockey team. He's clearly a sports fan, but his, I guess, greatest sports-related achievement, no doubt, is landing the 2014 Winter Olympics on his home turf. But what about these other concerns, including the gay rights and human rights abuses that have been alleged in Russia? Has that become an issue there yet?
Sure. This has been an issue, of course, in the months leading up to these games. No end to the discussion, of course, of the gay propaganda law, as it's known, which limits, the promotion of non-traditional sexual relations. So there were calls for boycotts in the West. There have been a lot of concerns raised about that. Broader concern is about human rights, Russia in general. Of course, this is not a new kind of discussion to happen around the Olympics. Vladimir Putin obviously anticipates. We've also moved to grant amnesty to some political prisoners here, most famously Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who had been Russia's richest man, the former CEO of Yukos Oil, set free after 10 years in prison. The young women from the protest riot also set free just short of the end of their sentence, which many people viewed as overly harsh given what they've done. But of course, from Russia's point of view, unfair. They say, look at China, which held the Beijing Games and was widely praised for those, and there was much as what was also obviously a human rights record that some people troubled.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is David Herzenhorn. He's New York Times Russia Bureau Chief. We're talking about, guess what, the 2014 Olympics in Sochi, Russia. That's where David is right now. That's all of what you just said, absolutely true. There's always conflict. There's always controversy. But the law that was passed that's brought so much concern was just passed in June. The timing is interesting. Did they not expect any pushback?
There's a good reason to expect that, of course, they knew exactly what they understood the timing. And this is one of the interesting things about being in Russia and covering Russia. It's a place where they want to send a message that views and policy were not dictated by the West. Vladimir Putin has an close and important political relationship with the Russian Orthodox Church. The Russian Orthodox Church has its own views on homosexuality and other issues for entirely other motivations and reasons, but there's no question that in the case of this legislation, those views do align somewhat. And I don't mean to minimize it. There are legitimate reasons to have concern human rights in Russia over the treatment of gay men, lesbians, transsexual, transgender folks. We've seen both an increase in awareness of the importance of these issues and also an increase of bias attacks on people as folks have been more assertive of their rights as these issues have come more into the public consciousness. Of course, we know that the United States and other Western countries have their own troubled track records, and it's only recently that we see quite a wider acceptance of gay marriage and equal rights.
Any protests that will be allowed are being put off some 7 miles from where a lot of the main action is. How are you expecting, or is anyone expecting Americans to respond when they arrive? Or I'm sure they're there by now, but what are the expectations that there might be a protest, might be a demonstration anyway?
Well, of course, the Olympic athletes are told quite pointedly that politics, you know, sports don't matter. Urge to keep politics out of this, and you know it'll be interesting to see how some folks feel about this, that they intend to and do carry out and send a message either by wearing a red flag or something that makes clear what they want to say to Vladimir Putin of these issues. So we track and field championships over the summer, you know, some athletes who had painted fingernails in rainbow colors to send that message. We do expect there will be, certainly, their delegations have been chosen to state that there are gay athletes attending these games, that no one wants to be silent on this matter. At the same time, everyone hopes that the major focus in Sochi is on the athletes, on the competition, on the ski slopes and the skate tracks, and that's where people come to see here.
Well, speaking of the track of the ski slopes and the ski tracks and the ice and so forth, there have been worries that hotels and other infrastructure just isn't up to snuff, isn't up to hosting an event like this, despite the record $50 billion price tag. Before we get to that price tag, are all the pieces in place?
Well, it's still a little rough around the edges. There's no question that some of my colleagues have complained about the accommodations that haven't quite been ready. Some of that is bureaucratic. Some of that is just a matter of, you know, getting paperwork done and checking in. Mm-hmm. Things have been not so convenient. I had to go and rescue a colleague this morning who was in her room because the doorknob broke and there was no way to open the door. There's no way to call the registration center. But these are minor issues overall, considering the huge undertaking of the Olympics. More importantly, what we haven't heard is complaining about the Olympic venues themselves, from the athletes, from the teams that are arriving. There's been only praise so far for the athletic venues. That's the most important thing. We haven't heard similar complaints about the villages where the athletes are staying. That's obviously much more important than how they're reporting. And Olympics, I am hearing from colleagues who've done many Olympics who say, you know, there are always these kinds of rough edges at the start, and that, in fact, you know, let's wait and see once we get through the opening tomorrow how these games come off.
Of course, Shaun White, the snowboarder, did drop out of one of the competitions because he was concerned about, but it wasn't about, it wasn't that the slope was inadequate or somehow unsafe per se. He said it was just very, very large, and he was worried about his safety.
Individual athletes, obviously, there's some injuries that have caused disappointment. You know, one of the big concerns a year ago was, would Sochi even have the question alone to Sochi? Although Sochi is the first city in a subtropical zone, there are palm trees along the streets to hold the Winter Olympics. Vancouver, as you know, had a similar issue, and extra snow had to be brought in.
Right.
Russia was, we know, wearing snow just in case. It turns out that there, in fact, is quite enough snow up in the mountains where the skiing and snowboarding events will take place. All the reports are that it's cold enough, snowy enough, that everybody's getting excited as these games get underway.
So what about that price tag for Sochi? Is it partly because we're grappling with two different climates, really?
Well, yes. It's a remarkable geography, and you really have to see it to fully understand it. Sochi is in one city, but in fact a ribbon stretched along the Black Sea coast. It's both Sochi and the district of Adler that are essentially two kind of city centers along the coast with beaches, pebble beaches along the way. And then right behind Sochi and Adler, you have the Caucasus Mountains, where the alpine events are being held. So you go up into the mountains, and it's snowy and cold. But when you're down by the coast, it's actually comfortable and in the 40s. And folks, you know, don't have to wear, you know, very heavy clothing as they walk through the Olympic villages here. This is a place that Putin hopes will be a huge vacation destination for Russians and for travelers from all over the world. It has the geographic appeal for that. Politics in Russia are complicated, and that may be one obstacle going forward, but there will be enduring questions about the cost. It's an astronaut price tag, more than $50 billion, even as a lot of it has gone into infrastructure. Really can't be directly tied to the games, power plants, new train lines, new roads, all things that will last beyond these Olympics. But there are serious questions that will be, was it worth it, given that number?
And what about the questions about corruption?
Russia always has these corruptions. You know, right. There's often a rule of thumb that, you know, anything that you build in Russia costs twice as much as it would to build anywhere else. You know, this ongoing problem that the Russian people, we hope at some point, will tire of and will demand that their government, there's no question widespread the reports are that, you know, some amount of money is often lost to waste, mismanagement, fraud. Of course, this happens in lots of countries, but it is a persistent problem in Russia.
Late last year, there was a train station bombing in Volgograd, which is about 600 miles from Sochi. There's a lot of concern about Chechnya, which has become something of a breeding ground for terrorism. This region has been unstable for a long time. And now we've heard about the so-called Black Widow terrorists, the women whose husbands were killed by Russian forces. Can you let us know or fill us in on what the concern is over there? We know U.S. Ships have been stationed. Is it in the Black Sea nearby?
Has been very clear, you know, warning Americans about a risk of a terror attack. We know that terrorists, you know, that are known to operate in the Caucasus, in these restive republics of Russia, where there are active insurgencies going on, have threatened to attack these games. On the other hand, security is extremely tight. It's no question that there is intense security all throughout the region, throughout Sochi, Adler, and up in the mountains. It is a real concern, obviously. We have had explosions in recent months, suicide bombers. This is an ongoing, my colleague Steve Myers has written quite extensively about the ongoing insurgency. Chechnya has been more stable, in fact, after Russia fought and two wars and the Muslim insurgency there. It's actually been more stable. We've seen republics like Dagestan, as folks know, that's where the Boston Marathon bombers had spent some time, Ingushetia, places where a desire among some to create an emirate, an independent Islamic emirate, and they're actually fighting an active civil war against so to speak. This is something that many people who don't understand about Russia, and one of the things that Vladimir Putin and his government face every day.
So can you give us an idea, you know, what's the mood on the streets? Are people excited? Are they nervous? Are the streets of Sochi very different from the streets outside of Sochi?
I think the excitement at this point, the fans are arriving, athletes arriving in their national colors. Folks are starting to, you know, engage in that old tradition of exchanging Olympic pins. The geography is just breathtaking. When you drive around, you know, you have the Black Sea, the snow-capped mountains right behind. I think people are very excited and eager to see the actual games get underway. We saw that today with the first snowboard events. Ceremonies tomorrow night, so I think there's a lot of anticipation, excitement building, and it'll continue for the next 3 weeks.
Well, David Herzenhorn from the New York Times, thanks so much for joining us. Hope you enjoy yourself and have a great time.
I appreciate it.
David Herzenhorn, he's New York Times Russia Bureau Chief. Coming up, we're going to go back in time a little bit and look more closely at the history of gay rights in Russia and going forward, what has precipitated the moves in recent years and months to tighten the reins on gays in Russia. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last June, Russia passed a law that bans gay propaganda to minors. The impact of the legislation has been unclear in the months leading up to the Sochi Olympics. Russia has come under harsh scrutiny for human rights abuses as well of gay protesters by the government and vigilante groups. But Russian President Vladimir Putin says Olympic athletes and spectators need not worry.
We aren't banning anything. We aren't rounding up anyone. We have no criminal punishment for such relations, unlike many other countries. So one can feel relaxed and at ease. But please, leave the children in peace.
That's a recent speech by Putin, translated into English, of course. For more on this and the history of gay rights in Russia, we've invited historian David Stone to join us. He teaches history at Kansas State University and has written an article forthcoming for OSU's online Origins magazine. The piece is entitled Russia, Gay Rights, and the Sochi Olympics. We'll have a link to Origins on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome to the show, David.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So politics are not new to Olympics.
Absolutely not. You can go back decades and find that politics has been part of the Olympic Games almost from the beginning. One of the parallels that people have been drawing recently is to the 1936 Berlin Olympics, in which Adolf Hitler used the Olympics as a showcase. And there's been comparisons. If the Olympics were held in Adolf Hitler's Germany, is the treatment of gays in Russia today somewhat similar, even though lesser in scale, than what was going on in Nazi Germany?
Have gay rights per se been an issue before? I mean, have there been laws passed before this?
Well, the interesting thing, as an historian, you know, one of my jobs is to try to put things in historical perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's striking about this is just how new this issue is. Mm-hmm. It speaks to how quickly attitudes towards gays and towards homosexuality have changed in the United States and in the West in general. One of the points that I make in the Origins article is that in Atlanta in 1996 and in Salt Lake City in 2002, both those places had laws against homosexual conduct. Now, they weren't actively enforced, but those laws were on the books, and as far as I can tell, nobody noticed or cared. It's been quite recent that this issue has come up in Western culture, and now in Russia in 2014. It's a very big deal.
Yeah, it's come up going in one direction in Western culture and going in another direction in Russian culture.
Yeah, that's, again, in historical perspective, that's one of the things that's really quite striking. Is that in the West, clearly, I think all sides would agree, wherever people may stand on the particular issue of gay marriage, say, I think everyone agrees that opinion in the West has been moving very rapidly towards greater toleration for gays and for homosexuality. And in Russia, the trends have been in very much the opposite direction. We have very good opinion polling in Russia today, and the opinion polls show that opinion has been moving very rapidly and strongly against toleration for homosexuality, whether you look at it as whether sort of a person's sexual orientation is their business and nobody else's, whether it's gay marriage, all those questions, opinion in Russia has been moving pretty rapidly and pretty strongly against toleration in the last 10, 15 years.
So why is that? Why is it going in that direction? What is influencing that?
I think there's several different things going on. I think there's a variety of ways of understanding this. A lot of it has to do with politics, and the particular politics of Vladimir Putin's regime in Russia today. One of the things that's quite clear about Putin's government is that it's very concerned about the possibility of popular discontent and anything popular discontent related that's tied to the West. And so that means that Putin's regime is looking for ways of keeping Western influence out of Russia, and of tying anything that smacks of opposition to the regime, tying that to outside forces, because that's always going to be a powerful political tool. If you can link political opposition to outsiders, that it's not genuine, it's not coming from inside, that's very helpful. And so one of the things that Putin can do is make homosexuals a persecuted group in society, and then tie them and tie agitation for gay rights to outsiders, that this is something that the West wants to do, that it's not genuine, it's not coming from real Russians. And that's politically useful. That does his regime a great deal of good in terms of solidifying opinion behind his government and cutting off the possibilities of the sorts of mass discontent that we've been seeing in Ukraine recently.
Hmm.
One of the longer-term trends, one of the things that Putin's government has been very upset about for many years now, are colored revolutions. And these are sort of revolutions in various post-Soviet states that get associated with particular colors. Georgia had a rose revolution. Ukraine had an orange revolution. And in Ukraine, you get sort of similar discontent now. And the regime is very wary of the possibility of mass discontent taking to the streets. And so it's looking for ways to solidify opinion and keep people satisfied with the Russian government. And making discontent and making protest, connecting that somehow to the West is very useful, and gay rights serves that purpose quite well.
So releasing the two leaders from Pussy Riot, who have been jailed for a long time, actually, that was part of that, getting them out of there?
Yeah, I think there's several things that are happening here. I mean, on the one, there's a kind of, it looks to me like a carrot and stick approach, sort of offer something with one hand, offer concessions with one hand, and then crack down on the other hand. Now, Pussy Riot has made the news, and they were on the report. They've been on in Western media. And so that's something that looks that's appealing to the West, that's recent news. But I think something that's even more significant, but that illustrates the bigger pattern, is that there are a number of oligarchs, these major Russian business figures, who've been attacked by the Russian government, who've also been let out of prison. Mikhail Khodorkovsky was arrested back in 2003. He owned a major oil company and came under attack by the Russian government. And it seems as though the reason for that was his unwillingness to sort of stick to oil and his efforts to get involved in politics. So he's been in prison on what most people consider trumped-up charges for a decade and has now been released. And so I think that the pattern here is that Putin, on the one hand, is seeking to demonstrate or to create the appearance of moderation and tolerance by letting some political prisoners out of prison. But on the other hand, is rallying support in opposition to what's seen as Western interference by things like this law against gay propaganda that we saw last summer.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking to history professor David Stone from Kansas State University. He has an article forthcoming in OSU's online magazine, Origins. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. If you have a question on WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Professor Stone, you're welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. To what extent is the vagueness of this law, or at least what it's perceived as vagueness by a lot of people in the West, part of the problem? It's unclear where to draw the line.
It is. I mean, and I think that's one of the signs of the way in which this law is designed to be politically useful. Because as it's written, it's difficult to know precisely what it means and precisely what can get you put into prison. The law itself doesn't actually mention homosexuality. The debate about the law clearly shows that it's primarily about homosexuality, but the law itself just talks about non-traditional sexual relations. And so that can mean a lot of things. It could mean polygamy, for example, but polygamy doesn't seem to have been part of the discussion at all. It's very much focused on homosexuality. But it talks about banning propaganda directed at minors. And the question is, well, what exactly does that mean? What counts as propaganda, and what does it mean if it's to be directed at minors? For example, let's say there's a news show that's talking about issues of homosexuality. If it's on in hours in which minors could be watching TV, does that count as being directed at minors? Nobody really knows. There was an incident that's been reported of a Russian high school girl who told her classmates that she was gay, and then she came under persecution for gay propaganda for saying that she was homosexual. And so that shows a couple things. Again, it shows that the implementation of this is going to make a very big difference in how it's actually going to be experienced by people in Russia. Because it's vague enough that Putin can talk about how it's really not so bad, but it's also vague enough that it can be implemented at the local level in a way that turns out to be quite repressive and quite cruel in some cases.
There are vigilante groups out now, nationalistic type groups. They're not necessarily associated with the police, but they're not being curtailed by the police either, that are going after people they perceive as gay or gay supporters. And there's lots of beatings. Human rights activists have shown lots of videos of that. Is that something that the Putin administration sees as a control or an out of control aspect of this?
Well, it's tough to say. I mean, one of the things, it's very clear that the Putin government can use nationalist groups, and especially youth groups, for its own purposes. For example, just quite recently, the Russian ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, resigned. He's coming back to the United States. But when he got to Russia, he was perceived as being anti-regime. He'd written a lot of things criticizing the government. And so when he got to Russia, a number of nationalist youth groups sort of shadowed him around or kind of camped outside the American embassy. And so these are things where, again, there's a nice mechanism by which Putin can distance himself from excesses, even when groups are doing things that in some ways prove quite useful. He doesn't have to say nasty things about the American ambassador because there's a pro-Kremlin youth group that's doing it for him. Now, I don't know that Putin necessarily wants gay people to get beat up, but if violent youth are directing their anger at an unpopular minority in Russia, that makes it much less likely that, violent youth are going to be engaging in protests directed against the Russian government.
Hmm.
It's a dangerous game to play because violent youth groups can turn on a dime and mm-hmm. decide that they're directing their anger somewhere else in another direction. But it's a useful distraction. And I think in lots of ways, the best way to understand this Russian law is as a useful distraction from potential discontent directed at Putin's government itself.
Do we know how aggressively the law is actually being enforced? You said at the local level is where it's going to come into play more.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, this is a matter for local prosecutors, and a lot is going to depend on the signals that local prosecutors get. And so far, at least, I mean, certainly in the run-up to the Olympics, Putin has been saying things that attempt to sort of minimize the significance of this law. But Russia is a very big place, and a lot is going to depend on how individuals decide that they're going to implement this, and also the signals that they get from Moscow. If the signals from Moscow once the Olympics are over are that it's time to crack down on gay propaganda, as the law defines it, then I think local prosecutors are going to do that. And so there's a lot that we just don't know. I mean, this is a long-term tradition in Russian history. There's an old saying that in Russia, the laws are terribly draconian, but they're tempered by not actually being enforced. And we just don't know. It seems as though, and we certainly have examples of people who've been prosecuted under this law. It's certainly the case that kind of vigilante groups are harassing gay people using this law as a signal. But it's much too early to have a sense of exactly how big this is going to be and how far it's going to go.
What about people who are wearing their Olympic pins, their rainbow Olympic pins that are being produced and being brought over there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a case where the signals that have come out, I mean, Russia is a place where the signals from Moscow matter. People listen to what Putin has to say, and mm-hmm. they calibrate the behavior accordingly. And the signals have been that the Olympics are not going to be a place in which people are going to be harassed. So my guess is that wearing rainbow pins is not going to get people in trouble. You know, there's 40,000 police in mm-hmm. Sochi, and so it's going to be difficult for vigilante groups to get much of a purchase there. The question will be, and we just don't know yet, competition is starting today, opening ceremonies are tomorrow. The question is going to be, are groups and individuals going to engage in public demonstrations of protest against this law? That would be the real test for how tolerant Russian police are going to be. But again, the signals from Putin have been that it's going to be very bad for his regime for foreign visitors or athletes to get arrested by the Russian police. That's not the kind of signal he wants to send. So I think individuals wearing rainbow pins in Sochi won't have any trouble. It'll be the response to demonstrations that's a little less clear. That's where we're going to see problems possibly arise.
Gay has associations with pedophilia and perversion in Russia. They certainly have had the same associations in the United States, but people have been educated and acculturated away from those. But it's not just the Russian authorities who are making this point. It's widespread in the Russian public. Has that been an ongoing thing? Is that widespread?
Yeah, it really is. And just to get kind of technical about the language mm-hmm. That people use— The word gay in the West has made it into Russia now. That term has been adopted as a way of indicating homosexuality, but it didn't really exist historically. That's new. And one of the more common terms that you would find in criminal literature or psychological literature about homosexuality, the term that was often employed was pederast, and that means sort of molestation of children. And so the word itself that was used in Russia carried with it this connotation of pedophilia. And I don't think that's gone away. You're absolutely right that in the West, we have learned to make a distinction that pedophilia takes place among homosexuals and heterosexuals, that there's no monopoly on that particular crime. In Russia, the perception is much more closely linked, is one that much more closely links homosexuality and pedophilia. And so in that sense, there to some degree is what I would say kind of an honest mistake on at least the part of some Russians, who perceive homosexuality as being about pedophilia and are reacting accordingly. It's not all about that. I think that's a mistaken view, but in some cases it may actually be an honest mistake that people are opposed to homosexuality in Russia because they think of it as specifically linked to pedophilia. in addition to this idea of it being politically useful to go after to gays as a minority.
Which is, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, and then so I think that the bigger issue in Russia, I think, is a residual prudishness about the objective, scientific, and well-founded discussion of sexual matters in the media that really didn't exist in the Soviet period. Soviet culture was very reticent to talk about sex and sexuality. And now in Russia, you, in a sense, got the worst of both worlds, that there's sort of pornography is easy to find. But the actual educated, mature discussion of sexual issues is still quite lacking.
And that predates Soviet Russia as well.
Yeah, I mean, the problem, when you go back, if the Soviets come into power in 1917, and you know, in the United States in 1917, you wouldn't necessarily have had lots and lots of sexuality in the popular media.
Right.
We have a different culture now. And so there's never really been a time in Russia where sort of the general culture talked about sexual issues in a scientifically informed way. I mean, certainly people have always talked about sex.
Mm-hmm.
But to talk about issues in a way that actually brings education, that's a little more rare. Even in the West, you know, the objective discussion of homosexuality is relatively new, historically speaking. And Russia, I don't think, has had that yet. And so, again, these popular perceptions can be based on ignorance and stereotypes, and those can be remarkably resistant to correction.
As we've learned in our own country, David Stone is a professor of history at Kansas State University. He has written an article forthcoming in the OSU's Online Origins magazine. It's a history magazine. We'll have a link to that for you on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment coming up for Professor Stone, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, will begin amid concerns about corruption, terror, and social unrest. We've been talking about Russia's harsh treatment of gays and lesbians, which has drawn international criticism, including from President Barack Obama, who has appointed several high-profile gay athletes to the Olympic delegation.
I think the delegation speaks for itself. You've got outstanding Americans, outstanding athletes. The fact that we've got folks like Billie Jean King or Brian Botano, who themselves have been world-class athletes that everybody acknowledges for their excellence but also for their character, who also happen to be members of the LGBT community, you should take that for what it's worth, that when it comes to the Olympics and athletic performance, we don't make distinctions on the basis of sexual orientation.
Professor David Stone from Kansas State University is with us talking about the history of gay rights in Russia. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. David, President Putin's policies toward homosexuality can't help relations between the U.S. and Russia. The president's not going there. That may have more to do with security concerns, but what does it do to the relations?
Well, it takes a relationship that's not particularly good at the moment and just adds one more aspect to the weight of things that are weighing down good relations between the U.S. and Russia. There are a lot of things that are on the agenda in terms of U.S.-Russian relations. Ukraine is an important one. Syria is another one. In those cases, the United States and Russia have opposed interests. And those opposed interests would be the case whether or not this law on gay propaganda had been passed last mm-hmm. summer. But it certainly doesn't help things that in the West there's a much larger perception of Putin's regime as one that is authoritarian because of the way that it is dealing with dissent at home, because of the way it is dealing with homosexuals in particular. And so that's an added burden to real conflicts over proper questions of foreign policy.
You write that besides the issue of gay rights per se, the history of thinking about rights in Russia and the West differ as well. They've gone down different paths. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, I think to understand Putin's regime, you need to see that there are several things that are coming together. And one big part of what's going on in Russia with this legislation is the convenience of an unpopular minority to sort of unite opinion and to link that unpopular minority with interference from the West. I think that's a big part of this. But there's also a real difference in the way that rights and thinking about rights was done in Russia both before the Russian Revolution, under the Soviets, and since that point. In the United States, we tend to think of rights as very much individual, that I as an individual have the right to believe what I want to believe and to say what I want to say and to live my life the way I choose to live my life. And as long as that doesn't hurt anybody else, then that's nobody else's business, that I will live my life the way I want to live my life as an individual. That's my right. And Russian thinking about rights has followed a somewhat different path. It's not that individual rights don't matter. It's that in the Russian tradition, there's been more of an emphasis on the community and the group. It's not that I have the right to live my life the way I want to live my life. It's that the group has an identity of its own, and that group will define the way it wants to be. And so there's a long tradition of Russian thinkers who have looked at the primacy of the group and the interests of the group and the needs of the group over the rights of any particular individual. And so my reading in the West of gay rights is that the change in popular opinion towards gay rights has been driven by a couple things. One is the sense that if an individual is homosexual, that doesn't hurt anybody else. Why does it bother me if my neighbor is gay? So what's the harm to me, and so why should it be any business of mine? That's part of it. And the other part in the West is that people live their lives the way they see that they ought to be living their lives, that people have the right to live their lives as they feel that they need to live their lives. And in Russia, that second part isn't quite as important. It still matters, and there's still lots of Russians that talk in terms of individual rights. But there's a longer tradition of the group and the collective having a say in the way individuals live their lives. And so the arguments in the West about individual rights just don't have quite the same purchase that they do in Russia. And I think that's part of the story of explaining what's going on.
And why when we question, well, why are people putting up with this? Well, because they have, because that's their tradition to put up with it.
Yeah, in a sense, when you look at what Putin and those around him have to say about this law, they tend to say things like, our culture is not your culture. The Russian values are not Western values. That our traditions are not your traditions. And so there's an emphasis on the collective tradition, the collective group and the values of the group, that is not the same way that these issues are discussed in the West. Certainly there are those in the West that do not want to see increasing toleration for gays that are opposed to gay marriage. Mm-hmm. Those people are certainly around in the U.S. The opinion polls suggest half of Americans are still not in favor of gay marriage. But the whole tenor of the argument tends to be different in the West, and it's because of this greater emphasis on individual as opposed to the group.
Now, there's lots of history of homosexuality in Russia in literature. It's not, I wouldn't say rampant, but it's certainly not, it wasn't hidden. It's a big part of Russian history.
Well, certainly it existed, and there are some key figures in Russian history that were very clearly homosexual or bisexual. Tchaikovsky, the composer, is one. Modern ballet was invented in Russia, and a number of the major figures involved in the creation of modern ballet in Russia were homosexual or bisexual. So that's certainly a part of Russian culture. But I think one of the things that sort of the Putin regime's response to that would be along the lines of, well, these are artistic elite types. They're influenced by the West. They're not true representatives of Russian values. True Russian values would be something different. And so while those people certainly existed, I mean, gay people, there have always been people who have been sort of homosexual or oriented in that way. In Russia, that particular orientation has been tied to the outside. It's seen often as something that comes not from inside Russia, but is something that's imported from the West. It's part of an alien culture in this kind of perception. And so for that reason, it's easier to condemn, it's easier to marginalize gays and lesbians if they're seen as outsiders in some way.
Now, historically, you also write that the law hasn't generally had much to say about female homosexuality, about lesbians. It's been mostly focused at men.
Yeah, and I think that's true generally speaking. The sort of laws in the West that criminalized homosexuality were almost always directed at men. Sort of female homosexuality just wasn't on the radar screen mm-hmm. of legal authorities. Just didn't matter from the point of view of the law. And so in Russia, that was true. Historically, primarily the focus was on male homosexuality. Female homosexuality was not part of the picture. Now, homosexuality was illegal under the Soviet Union from 1933 up until soon after the Soviet Union fell. This new law doesn't make a distinction between male and female homosexuality. It's directed at propaganda, but propaganda can be either for gays, lesbians. It doesn't matter in terms of the law. It's propaganda in favor of non-traditional sexual relations. And so to that degree, I mean, it's a little ironic that to that degree, the law is equal opportunity. It sort of applies equally to men and women. And lesbianism, in a sense, has been brought into the legal system in that way.
But my sense of how it's being, how the harassment's being carried out, the enforcement, such as it is on a local level, seems to be aimed at men.
To a degree, I mean, it's still so early; it's hard to have good, solid data.
Okay.
Anecdotally, it certainly seems that people getting beat up for being gay—that's primarily directed at men. And I think that's just the tradition that. Men wouldn't want to sort of videotape themselves beating up women. Men beating up men, that's something that, you know, if you're a young tough and you want to sort of achieve a reputation for toughness, beating up men, okay, that's fine. But beating up women, that would seem not so good. But certainly the law has been enforced in some degrees on women. I mean, I mentioned the example of a Russian woman high school student who came under attack from this law. So the enforcement of the law is not exclusive to men. Again, popular vigilante attacks, that seems to have been directed mostly at men, but we really don't have good systematic data to know that for a fact.
When the Soviet Union banned it or made it illegal, what do we have any idea how many people were affected by those laws, how many people were put in prison for being gay?
It's hard to get good data on that as well. We really don't know for sure. The best guess that I've seen is on the neighborhood of 1,000 a year. But that's a best guess. It seems like a reasonable guess, but we really don't have good, solid data on that. Certainly there were people in Russian prisons who were there for homosexuality. Now, Putin would point out, and he'd be correct, that that happened in the West, too. People could go to jail in the West for homosexuality. Mm-hmm. But in the Soviet Union, again, it seems as though about 1,000 a year is the ballpark figure.
And what about the gay rights movement in the Soviet Union, the LGBT movement for human rights? How is that ebbed and flowed over time?
There's much we still don't know. As far as we can tell, there really isn't much of a movement in Russia and when it's the Soviet Union. Under the Soviets, any organization outside the reach of the state was illegal. You couldn't organize a popular movement. If you did, you were breaking the law. And so when it came to protest, there were lots and lots and lots of things that one could protest in terms of human rights. And gay rights were very low on the agenda. And again, I don't think that's much different than in the West.
Right.
Certainly the gay rights movement came about as a powerful grassroots movement well after, say, the civil rights movement mm-hmm. For African Americans. And so we really shouldn't be too surprised that there's not a large gay rights movement in the Soviet Union, under the Soviet Union. It's become more visible in Russia since the Soviet Union fell in 1991, but for reasons that are obvious, it's still not nearly to the strength of the movement in the West, in part because of popular harassment, in part because of the new laws against propaganda. That has certainly put a damper on the ability of people to organize.
Has the Internet had any impact?
Certainly. I mean, one of the things about Russia today, generally speaking, not just about gay rights, is that the Internet is a place where if there's going to be free expression and vigorous discussion of issues, it's going to be on the Internet. The Russian government has fairly tight control over mass media, television and radio, less so on newspapers. Newspapers have smaller circulations than they used to. The government doesn't control newspapers or influence newspapers quite as much as other forms of mass media. It's the Internet, in part because of the difficulty of controlling it, where you really get the full expression of the full range of opinion. And so the Internet, in lots of places, not just in Russia, has become the venue for organization of protest movements, whether it's against Putin's regime in general or specifically in favor of gay rights.
Now, something else that was outlawed in Soviet Russia was religion, church, including the Russian Orthodox Church, and yet that has been said to be very strongly behind the new laws, the new law from last summer, and the anti-gay movement.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't that religion was per se illegal in the Soviet Union. The place of religion sort of ebbed and flowed over time. There were times in which there was more persecution and times in which there was less.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never a place that the church was completely wiped out. It was more that if you wanted to be a Communist Party member or sort of rise in society, sort of being visibly religious was not in your interest.
Okay.
But sort of if you were just a rank-and-file factory worker and you happened to go to church, that was not going to be a very big deal.
All right.
Now things have changed. Certainly Putin's regime wants to associate itself with the Russian Orthodox Church. It's looking for ways of legitimizing itself. And one of the ways of legitimizing itself is attacking unpopular minorities. But another way to legitimize itself is to link itself with the Russian Orthodox Church. And the Russian Orthodox Church has seen some benefits from this as well. If it has the sponsorship of the Russian government, then things can get easier for the church as well. There's been this collaboration between the two bodies. Not all the time and not on every issue, but certainly both sides there see an advantage in cooperation. Now, and it's worth saying also that when Putin talks about the gay propaganda law, he doesn't just refer to the Russian Orthodox Church. He goes out of his way to stress that what the Russian government is saying is not out of line with lots of traditional faiths. He specifically links what he's doing to the Russian Orthodox position, to the Catholic position, to the Islamic position. He's looking for, in a sense, backing from lots of circles for the new law.
I thought it was really interesting that you said another possible explanation is the desire to increase population growth, and that, you know, supporting gay rights works in diametric opposition to that.
Yeah, the one of the things that the Russian government is concerned about, and this is, again, true of Western Europe, is low population growth. The United States has a much higher population growth rate than Western Europe or Russia, also has higher levels of immigration. And so the United States' population is continuing to grow. Birth rates in Europe generally, and in Russia in particular, are far below replacement rate. In terms of the number of births per woman that would lead to a stable population. Russia and Western Europe alike are well below that. And so one of the things that Putin said is that it's important to get Russian population growing. The problem is that gays in Russia are still a very, very small minority, and there's lots of more obvious things that the Russian government could do if it was really concerned about population growth. The Russian divorce rate is among the highest in the world. The Russian abortion rate is among the highest in the world.
Hmm.
If the Russian government was really concerned about population growth, there are other things that it could do. The difference would be, I think, that if it were to, say, restrict access to abortion or make divorce more difficult or do things like that to try to increase the birth rate, that would hit a much larger section of the population. More people would be unhappy about it. The nice thing about gay rights is that the Russian government can talk about the issue of population, but the group that's actually victimized by that would be a much smaller group, and so not as much of a danger politically to the Russian government.
David Stone, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
David Stone, he is a professor of history at Kansas State University, and he's also the author of a forthcoming article in OSU's online magazine Origins. It's entitled Russia, Gay Rights, and the Sochi Olympics. We'll have a link to Origins on our website at WOSU.org/All Sides. Thanks for joining us today, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.